Edith Stein's Science of the Cross is an intellectual exercise. That intellectual exercise actually comes forth in many ways from the experiences of her life. She certainly takes apart John of the Cross and then reflects upon that later in her works, adding to, subtracting from it. But you can see throughout the work that her experience, her life experiences, are reflected here and there in what she has to say. So, what I will do is today is essentially go through her life in a rather rapid way. Obviously, seeing things from my perspective, reflecting upon her. So hopefully your tomatoes are very ripe, so when they're thrown, you know, they splatter very well. Edith Stein's dad dies when she is still very young. She's around 3 years old. And her mom, as other women in her family have previously done, takes responsibility for the family business and makes it grow. Her work ethic seems to find a home in Edith. She is practical, efficient, and has good business acumen. Though the Jewish religion is practiced in her home, the business takes precedence. It must, if the family is to survive. The household in which she lives, as a result, has a routine that rarely varies. She no longer has a dad, but her mom's hard work provides a sense of safety. They have enough food to eat. They have a comfortable home in which to live. Their family has a steady income on which they can rely. Also, Edith is living in Germany. It is a time of relative peace before the outbreak of World War I. Her early years then are lived under a stable government in which the Germanic people flourish economically. National pride saturates the world in which she lives. Her family at one point moved away from an area reclaimed by the by Poland because they could no longer live out as Germans. So their national identity is very strong. The effects of all these circumstances are that Edith is free to develop an interior world in which there is clarity and a strong sense of right and wrong. She adopts, consciously or unconsciously, the business work ethic of her mom and begins to excel in school. Naturally brilliant, she sees possibilities open before her in the academic world, and she becomes self-sufficient in her work. Referring back to the poem of the last time, her house stands on a foundation that is well built, and the house atop begins to accumulate articles and memories that are easily displayed. The thriving family business permits Edith to continue her education in the University of Breslau and then in the University of Göttingen, I think that's how you pronounce that, and finally in the University of Freiburg. Gradually, she also moves away from the influence of her family and religion and comes under the influence of the academic culture in which the existence of God is severely questioned. She experiences great success and is readily acknowledged in the academic world. Her only stumbling block, it seems, is that the discrimination against women in German society, especially in academics. It is during this time period that the image that she has created of God, based upon the religion and society of her youth, becomes superfluous. She moves towards atheism and critically questions everything. By the way, I think that's wonderful. This move, in turn, results in the image that she has created of herself to stop working. She, in its place, creates a new image, and the first cracks in the foundation of her youth begin to show themselves. While studying at the University of Breslau, Edith hears of a new branch of philosophy that attracts her. I must admit, when I was studying philosophy, none of the philosophies really attracted me. No. She decides initially to study for a semester with Edmund Husserl, the father of the philosophy called phenomenology, but soon decides that this philosophical discipline requires a lifelong commitment, so she transfers to the University of Gottingen, where she succumbs to the full influence of Husserl and phenomenology. The approach used by phenomenology, put simply, is to reserve judgment on human events by concentrating on the study of consciousness and the objects of direct experience. Got all of that? More cracks appear in her foundation when her safe world changes with the outbreak of World War I. She witnesses pain and suffering. She questions the brutality of humans against each other. She experiences death firsthand. None of these life experiences fit in the world that she has created. Her search for answers leads her, using the discipline of phenomenology, to concentrate on suffering and empathy for her doctoral thesis. Edith successfully completes her degree in philosophy under Husserl and becomes his assistant. As his assistant, Edith reads, catalogs, rereads, recatalogs, and comes to understand Husserl's philosophy almost as well as he understands his work. The cracks in her foundation continue to deepen as she is reintroduced to religion, first academically, and then specifically in the persons of Adolf and Ian Reinach. Adolf and Ian are Christians. When her teacher and mentor, Adolf, is killed as a soldier in World War I, Edith is devastated. her foundation and the house atop crumbles. Anne, Adolf's wife, unknowingly assumes the role of teacher as she lives in hope that she and Adolf would one day be reunited. Edith speaks of this experience as her first encounter with the cross and resurrection. Her interaction with God, now more through the person Jesus, results in a more personal and experiential encounter. A new image is forming. Somehow, this experience embodies for her the thought that Jesus is the physical image of God and captures her imagination. That Jesus is crucified connects with her doctoral work on suffering and empathy. That Jesus, in the theology of the day, is seen as a sacrifice, as atonement for sins, reinforces much of her philosophic thought, and it takes her beyond to an experience that she can't fully identify. Gradually, Edith moves away from the dominant influence that Husserl has on her, and she applies for a teaching position in several universities, and each are denied, often without her application being read or considered. She is a woman, and women are not considered for higher education teaching positions. And she is in a field of study, philosophy, that reinforces that discrimination. The attention that she has been receiving in the academic world dries up. And the dismantled foundation and house is dismissed as useless. She does eventually get a position in a teacher's college, an accepted place for women. It is during this time that the source of her desired attention begins to change. She, while visiting friends, is left alone for a day, and she happens upon the autobiography of Teresa of Avila. What she reads redirects her imagination. Edith rapidly moves toward that which she feels will help her to see more clearly that a new foundation and house is being constructed within her. A construction that is more happening to her rather than she is causing. The writings of Teresa and later John of the Cross blend with her work in phenomenology, and in particular in her work with empathy and suffering. She discovers that she is attracted to the Carmelite life and seeks to enter the religious order after her baptism into Catholicism. Edith, a few years earlier, had seen no need for the God that she knew as a child. And hopefully we all come to that at some point in our lives. The divine, as she understood the divine, didn't fit into her way of thinking. She was a scientist. Her approach to life was directed by the scientific method. And you can see this very much in her writings. Phenomenology, especially her experience with suffering and empathy, somewhat softens her views. She also begins to see that human suffering and empathy cannot be successfully explained by her philosophical thought, her philosophical work. It defies the applications that phenomenology and other philosophies can generate. It is this failure, especially the death of her teacher and mentor, Adolf, that seems to be what leads Edith onto a different path. It is what causes her eventually to separate from Herschel. Not that they become enemies or anything. She just sees herself moving in a different direction than him. Faith cannot be experienced by our egos, or as Edith talks about, the I within us. It is a reality that is beyond our mental capacity to understand. Unfortunately, we often reduce faith to mental constructs that can be understood by our I or our ego. Faith, like love, suffering, and empathy, is an experience that happens to us. It is a reality that somehow causes us to fall through our hands into the hands of God. Something that we can't cause to happen because our minds cannot assure us that God will catch us. Suppose he makes an error. Suppose God has just put hand cream on his hands. Sorry, my mind is kind of weird at times. Such insecurity cannot be tolerated by our egos, or as Edith says, the I within us. And the instrument of our egos, our minds. So she talks about very often that our minds, the I, cannot penetrate the deepest part of ourselves. Only God can penetrate because God dwells there. Later, as a means of introducing John of the Cross to the German world, Edith develops what she calls the science of the cross. And in some ways, as I read her works, it's almost she is calling this a science of the cross, but in reality she's saying you can't use the scientific method to get there. She attempts to interpret John's writings in a way that what he has to say can be understood by her contemporaries. And as you read The Science of the Cross, I often had to ask myself, why would anyone want to understand this stuff? Edith, as is John, is affected by the accepted theology, classical scholasticism of her time, and is this theology is reflected in her work. She does, however, venture into areas that stand in contrast with the accepted atonement theology. Atonement theology essentially is a human or animal sacrifice is made in order to free another from an obligation or a failing. That's atonement theology. And so we hear it throughout liturgy, for example. In, last weekend, it speaks of God, well, I guess the Feast of the Immaculate Conception, it speaks of God knowing ahead of time that Jesus is going to die for sin, and therefore Mary benefits from that. That's atonement theology. It's also speaking of God controlling things along the way. That's essentially scholasticism. This prevalent theology is found both in John's theology and the theology of the 20th century to today. Jesus, in atonement theology, has to die, be sacrificed, in order to save us from our sins. That is, to pay the price of redemption. We all know that language. Edith uses the language of John in which she speaks of mortification and self-denial as a way of life that needs to be chosen. Certainly in the academic world, she knew that way of life. She then cautions that choosing mortification and self-denial can be another way by which we take on extra baggage that will prevent us from entering the narrow gate. We don't often hear the second part of that. A willingness to observe and love, be open, leads us to truth and honesty. Even here, however, truth and honesty cannot be complete. We will, as long as we live, it seems, carry something with us, no matter how small. Love and mercy find a way to get us through the narrow passage that we would be prevented from entering because we are carrying something. If we are sure, certain, that we can enter, however, we are prevented by the certitude that we carry. The manner of death that Jesus experiences, crucifixion, as a criminal, evokes a lack of certainty and certitude. Jesus is in agony both physically and spiritually, which taxes his normal willingness to remain open and forcefully raises questions that he cannot mentally grasp. Why are you abandoning me? The science of the cross brings Edith to an acceptance that God, like faith, suffering, and empathy, cannot be mentally grasped. The I cannot grasp God. The best that we can do is observe the effects of God relating with us in our lives. For example, we observe ourselves being kind to another or not taking offense. And very often that surprises us. Surprises me. The inability to mentally grasp, that is, take credit for our kindness, though we will definitely try, causes us agony, maybe not a great deal of agony, but a certain amount of agony, because God is beyond our capacity to mentally grasp. Then she comes to a place in which she experiences an openness to accept that what is impossible for us, God makes possible for us, but in a completely different way than we can imagine. So just as we think we've got it all together, the game changes. And all the pieces with it. Edith infers that we tend, on our journey, to reach a plateau and establish a camp. There's nothing wrong with that. It is a pleasant place to be, and unless something happens to us causing the camp to be destroyed, we will not continue our journey further into the unknown darkness, into God. She reiterates numerous times that God is unknowable by our minds, by our egos, by the internal eye. Dying to self, then, is another way of recognizing that the ego, the internal I, cannot comprehend God. As long as we live primarily in our internal I, in our ego, we are prevented from experiencing God no matter how spiritual we appear to be. All we can do is experience the image of God that we have mentally created. That is, God is the image and likeness of our egos, of our internal eye. We take a selfie and say, "This is God."
That's scary.
I don't have long enough arms, though. I need one of those sticks. There's something happening to us can be experienced as and called evil. It interrupts the way in which we are interpreting life. We feel at a loss. A feeling that we do not like. Evolution keys?
Oh, yes.
It is only after the event that we might begin to recognize that the cause of our disruption is our encounter with the God who is beyond the image generated by our ego. The pain and the comfort often come in the form of experiencing ourselves being sustained rather than destroyed by the encounter. If we reflect on the death and resurrection of Jesus, there is an apparent disruption there. And there's not. The life of Jesus is sustained. We call that resurrection. And that happens in our own lives as well. Love is experienced and remembered, and the foundation and house atop begins to be rebuilt from the wreckage. This requires that we keep our feet in the fire. This requires that we practice a willingness to deal, interact with our feelings of fear and anger. This requires that we remain with what we feel and think are sin until we receive a blessing from what we demonize as evil. Getting rid of our fear, our anger, our sin too quickly might initially evict the demon. But as Jesus says in the Gospels, the demon returns and, finding the place swept and cleaned, returns with many more demons to take up residence. The backdrop for Edith's interpretation of John is the rise of the Third Reich. The Carmelite sisters in Cologne, where Edith enters, become concerned for her and her sister's safety. They, as quickly as possible, make arrangements for them to transfer to a monastery in Holland. I'm sure they had to go through the male higher-ups in the Carmelite order in order to have that happen.
Yeah.
I'm just being facetious, sorry.
It's true.
You can strike that later on.
Okay, yeah.
It's probably true, though.
Well, yeah. Life is once again happening to Edith. The advancing German army, however, soon captures Holland too. And the Carmelites try once again to expedite another transfer for Edith and her sister to Switzerland. This transfer never happens. Edith is arrested and sent to a concentration camp where she lives out her remaining days caring for children whose parents are too distraught to care for them, are too sick, or have been killed. She, in this way, lives God's union with her in a way that she could never imagine. Questions?